Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
Yeah, what is up? It is Monday, cranking it up for another week. Big week, enthusiasm. I call it enthusiasm now. Positivity, excitement, fun, goofing around. We will get you through your week some way, somehow. By the way, I was looking, coming up for you in just a moment. Sam Smith is going to join us. We got him. Okay, cool. Yep.
And Sam is one of the great NBA writers that is out there. He now writes for Bulls.com, but for years wrote for the Chicago Tribune and wrote The Jordan Rules, the book that was mentioned last night in the documentary. Sam, thank you for doing this. How are you holding up?
Yeah, I wonder why everybody was calling me today. Nobody usually ever calls me.
this thing is making you a star, Sam.
Yeah, no, I told somebody, I said, you know, I've been standing in the same place, and the circus came back to my front door. So,
right. Yeah, you didn't move.
Exactly. They all moved around, and I've still been with the Bulls.
Sam, the book you wrote was about the first Bulls championship run, the team that beat the Lakers, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I read that book back then, and I'm trying to remember, what was the biggest revelation? What got the most coverage when the book came out? Was it the fact that Jordan liked to gamble, or was it something else?
No, the gambling wasn't really in there, you know, other than just the gambling, you know, like you saw in the documentary, you know, playing cards or tossing coins, nothing. You know, all the gambling stuff, and that's probably, you know, what heightened elevation of the book, because literally, like I think to say, probably the same weekend the book came out, he went on this gambling weekend with this Slim Buller drug dealer, you know, unbeknownst to him, and the bail bondsman who was financing the weekend got murdered, and he had a Jordan strap in his, you know, bag. And so, you know, all this stuff blew up all of a sudden when the book came out. It wasn't so much any one revelation. It was more the accumulation of, you know, all these kids singing Be Like Mike. And, you know, some days, you know, it wasn't so much fun to be with Mike, you know, because he was this incredible manic competitor, you know, not only wanted to beat you, you know, then Phil used to say, you know, Dr. J wanted to beat you as bad, but Michael made you go home without your lunch crying. And, you know, this incredible way he had about him. You know, actually, Kobe was a lot like that. And you guys know Kobe was, many of his career wasn't the most favored teammate, but it was, you know, that was the drive to excellence, and the notion evolved over the years. And in this documentary came to be, well, you know, leadership is not about making friends. It's about, you know, in part driving people to heights that even they didn't think they were capable of, because, you know, that's where you wanted to get. And so, you know, Jordan had been, it really was a myth being portrayed out, and David Falk addressed that. You know, we wanted to, you know, create this mythical figure of, you know, perfect guy and all the right products, you know, the typical American, you know, apple pie, Coca-Cola, all this stuff. And those were the products he was endorsing, you know, Chevrolet, literally. He had every one of those, and, you know, great smile, nice looking guy, you know, on David Letterman, good sense of humor. And, you know, being around him then was great fun. You know, very outgoing, accommodating. I always said, other than Magic, he was the most accessible, open and accommodating superstar in sports. It was basically him and Magic, and he could jump higher. And so it's sort of the revelation, if you would, with two things. One is, he wasn't a perfect kid next door every day. And two, in the Chicago market developed that, well, you know, this is the Chicago Bears now. We're a one-hit wonder. You know, championship runs over. It runs over because, you know, all these internal stripes have been revealed. And, of course, nobody can survive that. And the team is going to break up and collapse. And, you know, this book is responsible. So there was, you know, there was sort of all this outrage and, obviously, worked out for more them than me, but they basically never lost after that. So I was able to hang around in somewhat safety.
Bulls beat writer Sam Smith is with us. He wrote The Jordan Rules, which was a book that was discussed in detail last night on The Last Dance. So it sounds like to me, and it's been a long time since I read that book, Sam, but it sounds like to me the gambling, the book, and the trip to Atlantic City all became sort of conflated into one big thing. How fair is it to say that?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It was sort of the accumulation, and it was the gambler from San Diego to golfer and Aquinas, you know, put out a book, saying Michael had welched, and you know, the combination of Michael's drive as a player, you know, 48 minutes, and literally, you know, the only guy who did play 48 minutes, despite everybody saying it, and this incredible celebrity that was growing year after year with his success, with his personality, with the endorsements and everything. And then it was, you know, it was not, I wouldn't say his resentment, but he, as I said, he had been so cooperative and accommodating and outgoing, and literally back then, and you know, being around the 80s, you know, you could sit with a player, you know, for two, three hours before a game and just chat. Locker rooms were open endlessly until 45 minutes before the game, you know, but he'd come in 3 o'clock because it was, you know, it was traffic. We had it too. And to come down from more suburbs where the players live to, you know, should cut downtown, to avoid the rush hour. They'd all come in early. Michael would sit in front of his locker and joke and chat with reporters, whoever came in, other teammates, whatever, for hours. And so, you know, he began to feel, you know, and some of the stories were just outrageous, to go into Atlantic City between games, big deal. You know, Iverson went after every game he played in his entire career, from Philadelphia to Atlantic City. And gambling now, I've noticed all these teams have partners in the gambling establishments. And I remember, you know, New York Times, of all places, wrote a big, you know, story condemning him during that New York series in 93 when they went down 0-2 after that stark stunk at the end. And said that, you know, he got in at 2 between games. I said, this was shocking to me. He usually gets in at 5, you know, because he never slept. You know, with legendary stories, which are true. He played cards till 5 and wore out Magic. As he said, at the Magic didn't finish the story. He wore him out playing cards. Magic couldn't stay up. And then he'd get up and play golf, you know, the next morning with Chuck Daly at 7, you know. And then he'd go to the game and he'd believe he'd score. And that's just who he was. And so he began to feel like, hey, after all my accommodation with you guys, after everything, this is the way you treat me. And you know, that was part of what they were explaining in the show when James was talking for him. There was a couple of weeks there where he said, screw you guys, I'm talking to you anymore.
Right. Which isn't completely unexpected. We're talking to the great Sam Smith, who's been a writer in Chicago since the Bulls started winning titles. That's the year the Jordan Rules came out. Sam, the most fans, if you talk to them, that were fans of the NBA in the 90s, think that had Jordan not left and gone to baseball, the Bulls would have won not 3-3, but 8 straight titles. Do you believe that?
No, they wouldn't have. There's no way. Now, of course, you know, the one who broke up the dynasty, the only one really, was Michael Jordan in 93. That was the one year they had a chance because Scottie and Horace were still in their prime, still great athletes, still there. Well, the only hook to that was the Rockets were the one team during the first, you know, three-peat, first dynasty era that they couldn't beat. And the Rockets had a winning record against them because Hakeem and Otis Thorpe on the front line and just overwhelmed Cartwright and Grant. You know, the Bulls' success was having these three great, in the early years, having these three incredible athletic defenders. You know, Michael, the best two-guard defender ever, probably. Scottie, the best three defender ever, probably. And Horace, who was in that era, the best athletic defender. And so you had these three incredible guys running all over the court, stealing the ball, pressuring. You know, 91 finals, you saw Magic having to turn around, dribble backward to get up the court. It was remarkable stuff. And so they could have in 93, 94, possibly, but like I say, Houston had a winning record against them literally in the first 3 years they won those championships, 91, 93. So it would have been a tough series. The other part of it is Michael, as he drove himself so much, you saw how often he was talking about, both in 92, 93, and 97, 98, about I'm gone, I have no regrets. He would burn himself out. The combination of celebrity and the ferocity he put into the game, that there was no way he could sustain that through 8 years. It was inconceivable that if he had stayed and not taken the baseball thing, that they wouldn't have had, you know, some sort of fallback. And, you know, and probably, you know, Rodman wouldn't have been available with the circumstances. Obviously, a lot of ifs, but there's no way the way Michael played and led his life and dealt with celebrity like nobody has. You know, there's been no player in the history of the league, probably in sports. You know, Michael is Babe Ruth and Muhammad Ali, and that he's not, you know, Tiger Woods, maybe. You know, nobody in team sports ever been like that has faced what Michael has, scrutiny and the attention and the popularity and the celebrity. It's just unheard of. And to sustain that with the way he played and the way he attacked life, you know, 21 hours a day of competing, there's no way they win an 8 titles.
So why do you think, I mean, obviously he left the NBA. Why do you think he chose to go to baseball as opposed to sort of disappearing for a while if dealing with the celebrity was one of the major issues?
It was very clear why he did that. He was unsure about returning 92-93. I'm pretty sure they had in the documentary, but he was talking that season. I think Randy Brown wasn't there then, but Ron Harper, no, he wasn't there then. Somebody mentioned it, who was on that team in 92-93, that he talked about it in the playoffs, last year, see me, and I remember that. I remember hearing him say that, and we all assumed that, you know, if he was just burned out, you know, 91, 92, the Dream Team didn't have a summer off, you know, in 93 with the gambling, that he just needed some time and he'd recover from this. But then when his father was murdered that summer, they were really close and really more like best friends than father-son. They hung out a lot together, did stuff together. And as devastating as that was, and then the media, again, piling on, you know, really one of the worst things I've ever seen in media coverage. There were a bunch of stories written that, his father was killed because of him, because of his gambling debts, which, of course, was all fabricated. But, you know, so now he's dealing with all this. And his father had always wanted him to be a baseball player, always wanted to see him. He was good when he was young. He was like an All-American or whatever the equivalent would be, won a Babe Ruth title when he was 12 or 13 as a pitcher or something. And they had talked about that. They talked to Jerry Reinsdorf in the late 80s about spending a summer in single A, and George Shinn when he owned the Hornets, also owned the minor league team in North Carolina, and they talked with him about it and never could kind of work it out, you know, with whatever commitments he had with basketball. You know, but then when that happened and his father got murdered, he decided that this would be his tribute to his father and his way of also getting away. Because even though he went in a public sort of sphere, you know, minor league baseball in Alabama was, Birmingham, Alabama was pretty separate from, the media would come down, but, you know, you're still separated, you're still traveling on the bus, because he bought the bus, it was a very good bus, you know, in these little small parks all over the place, you know, 3,000, because, you know, they had all-time attendance, but it still would be like 8,000 or something. And he said it was nothing, you know, like it, and there was a chance for him to just get away, and, you know, he would be up at, you know, 6 in the morning when sun up came and practicing, and because, you know, media guys don't get up at that time. So yeah. He was pretty alone. So it was a way for him to do two things, give it, you know, his own tribute to his father and, you know, and then also get away from everything he was dealing with.
Sam, last thing. Why do you think, you covered Phil Jackson as much as anybody. Phil coached for 20 seasons and he won 11 titles. Some people always say, well, he had Jordan and Pippen and Shaq and Kobe, but other coaches had those guys and didn't win titles. To what do you attribute Phil's extraordinary success?
Well, he was a great basketball X's and O's guy, which he never got credit for. When he was with the Knicks in the late 60s, early 70s teams, he was hurt. He had an up back surgery, I think, the 69-70 season when Knicks won the first title. And Red Holtzman had him sit on the bench with him to be an assistant coach you know, because Phil was such a good basketball guy. And, you know, with all the Native American stuff and the Zen and all the image built up around Phil, that always got lost, that he could sit down and diagram plays and do all that silly stuff with the best of them. And also was a great strategist. But beyond that, he, because of his upbringing, you know, his parents, Pentecostal ministers, you all know his story as well as we do, you know, saw the humanity in athletes. Just didn't see him as you know, figures on the field, as human beings, and treated them that way. And it might be a little pat on the back. And, you know, it was a way of Phil showing. He always knew, you know, when players' wives, anniversaries and birthdays and things. He was just aware of his team like a congregation and the way they had to be treated differently. And one thing he always did with Michael, which was great, and it really endeared Michael to him in a lot of ways. Michael, early on, was no fan of the triangle, which he said early on in that documentary, I think. Phil always made it a point to never ask Michael for anything. And as Michael said in this, and everybody was always asking Michael for something. And you saw the parade. I remember games where referees would come in afterwards to get an autograph, get a ball autographed after the game. And players and tickets. You saw Randy Brown and the thing. Never once did Phil, and Phil had, you know, five kids, and never got an autograph, never, you know, did anything, never asked Michael for anything. And Michael came to understand, you know, in his prism of his world, to see, you know, this is a guy, and that's what players want, all players. This is a guy not interested in getting something from me. He wants to help me get to where I need to be. And I think that's what, you know, that's what players have always come to understand with Phil. He has their best interest in mind, which, you know, parallels his interest, of course. But he's also somebody who understands, appreciates, and celebrates the humanity of individuals. And that resonates with players, and that makes an impact. And you're exactly right. A lot of great players in the history of the league. And I think that's the great thing, one great thing to me with this documentary. It's showing the excellence of Phil, and in part why he was so successful with varied groups of people. I mean, it's not interesting. Let me tell you that. It's not easy to be successful, not only with Michael Jordan, as great as you can be, but Scottie Pippen, who was off the rails every year about anger about his salary or contract, whatever. Dennis Rodman, you know, what coach is allowing the rope to Dennis Rodman? And you see even great Popovich, who's one of the great coaches of all time, couldn't deal with him at all and just sent him away for nothing, basically, because he was blowing up his team because of the circumstances. Jerry Krause, this erratic GM, this bunch of role players that just fit in, you know, one way kind of guy to help plug a fit hole here and there. And, you know, so if you look at that roster at the end of 97-98, Rodman, you know, kind of losing it. Scotty kind of giving up for half the season. And then Ron Harper, just a shadow of what he was when he was the Clippers athletically. And Luke Longley, Steve Kerr, Judd Bushler, Andy Brown. I mean, really, it looked like barely a playoff team. They had 62 wins. And so, you know, I think it just showed how, you know, how deserving Phil is to be considered the greatest coach, along with Red Auerbach. Those are the two elite coaches in the history of the game, and everybody follows after those two.
All right. Hey, listen, Sam, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate it. It's fun seeing you on the documentary, the book, a number of books. The Jordan Rules, the one that was discussed last night. And, of course, Second Coming, The Strange Odyssey of Michael Jordan from Courtside to Home Plate to Back Again. Both those books, great reads. And, Sam, we appreciate your time a lot. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, good. Good to talk to you guys. Take care.
Thank you, Sam Smith. Cool stories, man, to have lived that on a day-to-day basis.
And he's been with them, you know, forever. By the way, did you see Netflix is going to do a fictional series on the Tiger King? Did you see who they picked to play Joe Exotic?
No.
All right, I'll tell you next.
All right, cool. Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right, 710 ESPN, Mason in Ireland. Hey, what's going on?
It is Monday. It is a new week. It is a new day. It is it's getting better out there. There's light at the end of the tunnel. John, you played some golf this weekend. How was that?
Boy, golf is taking a long time to play because so many people want to play. Yeah.
But
it's better. Hey, it's better than sitting at home doing nothing.
Do you get a tee time and then you have to stand 6 feet apart and wait?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's. I mean, I people have much bigger problems than me, so I'm glad I was able to get outside. But
Morales told me he played 36 on Friday.
Yeah, that, he must have found a place that was playing fast because the place I played was playing really slow.
He's playing my old nemesis, John, my old nemesis, the course that destroyed my golf game forever.
You have no golf game.
I had one briefly until I ran into Black and Gold in Orange County. Black and Gold ruined me for golf.
That is a good course. All right, so do you know yet who's going to play Joe Exotic in the next
series? No, I have no idea who's going to play
Funch,
Joe.
Funch, do you know?
I saw this earlier.
Okay. So, Mace, I'll give you hints until you get it.
Okay, good, good.
Like Joe Exotic, this guy, I think, is a little nuts.
Okay.
All right.
Let's go.
He is, I believe, a little older than Joe Exotic.
Randy Quaid.
No, maybe a little younger than Randy Quaid. This guy is often impersonated. He comes from a very famous family.
Charlie Sheen.
No.
Famous family.
Yes. His last name is not the same as his family's.
Emilio Estevez.
No. His family is tied to perhaps the greatest two movies in the history of movies.
Oh, okay. Wait a minute. Scott Conn.
No, they're more like created those movies.
Nicolas Cage.
There it is. Nicolas Cage. Isn't that a perfect choice?
Oh, I love that. I love that. That is so great. That is so great. Is this the one that Kate McKinnon's going to be in?
No, those are two different projects.
Look how hot Joe Exotic has become. Two movies about the guy.
Well, the thing Nicolas Cage is working on is a Netflix TV series. I'm not sure the one Kate McKinnon's working on, but I think it may be a movie. But
Nicolas
Kate's going to play Carol Baskin in the one she's doing, and now Nick has to find a Carol Baskin for his.
Oh, Nicolas Cage is just outrageously weird. He is a perfect choice for that role. There's not an announcement who's going to play him. Everybody's angling. I know Edward Norton's trying really hard to play Joe Exotic, who I think would be really good.
Well, that guy could play anything, Edward Norton.
So you want to hear a crazy story? You know, everybody knows the movie Primal Fear, right?
Right. Great movie.
Great movie. And, God, do I spoil that or not?
Yeah, it's 20 years old.
Okay. So throughout the movie, Edward Norton is playing like this kind of hick kid who may or may not have committed a heinous murder. And he went and auditioned for a guy named Hawk Koch, who's Howard Koch Jr. He presented himself as this kid from West Virginia, and he became a finalist for the role. And he had that sort of southern, you know, that sort of southern dumb, you know, Aaron kind of thing. They cast him in the role. And only later did they find out he went to Yale Drama School and was playing the role of a hick kid from West Virginia in order to get the job as Aaron in Primal Fear.
Okay, so he actually played a split role of Roy and Aaron.
Yes.
That comes out in the movie. And here's the amazing thing that when I became a huge Edward Norton fan.
Yep.
So the movie hits, and it's a big smash.
Yep.
Richard Gere's great in it. Who was the guy that played? Was it John? The guy who played the dad on Frasier.
John Mahoney.
Yeah, John Mahoney's in it.
Yeah, was great in it.
Maura Tierney's in it. There's a bunch of Laura Linney's in it.
Yep.
So the movie becomes a big hit, and he, of course, is getting asked to do a lot of press.
Yep.
He refused to do any press.
Yep.
Because he didn't want people to know whether he was Roy or Aaron.
Yep.
He wanted the character to stand on its own.
Yeah.
So
I was doing the Snyder Show then, and I kept saying to Dave Singer, Dave Singer was booking, I'm like, get me Edward Norton. Now, he can't be that big. We should be able to get Edward Norton. I remember just being really hard on Dave, saying we've got to get Edward Norton. And as it turns out, he did no media whatsoever. None.
Right. And just let that movie kind of speak to its own.
Hey, I got an interesting question here,
okay.
And this came in on email. By the way, 877-710-ESPN, 877-710-ESPN. So this came in on email, and I find this interesting. The idea is if they started a Universal Sports Hall of Fame, in other words, encompassing all sports,
okay.
You can put one player in from the NFL, from Major League Baseball, from the NBA and from the NHL, who is your first class of inductees?
Is that a great question? Well,
this is from Juan Frausto on my email.
The NHL is the only one that's easy. The NHL is Gretzky.
It's Gretzky, no question.
But every other one is hard. Like, for example, NFL. Do you go Jim Brown? Do you go Tom Brady?
Do you go Jerry Rice?
I'd probably go Brady.
Yeah, I think I'm going Brady.
NBA, do you go Bill Russell?
Nope.
Do you go
Kareem?
Michael
Jordan?
Do you go Michael Jordan?
Especially, I mean, call it recency bias, but are you kidding me? I'm going Jordan.
Okay, but Kareem won 3 college titles at UCLA and 6 in the NBA.
I'm still going Jordan. Jordan.
I'm not going to blame you. Baseball.
Baseball to me is
might
the
be
toughest
the hardest
one. It's the toughest one. You could go Babe Ruth.
Didn't play against black guys.
You could go Sandy Koufax.
There. Too short of a career.
You could go Joe DiMaggio.
Maybe.
You could go Ted Williams.
What about Hank Aaron?
You could go Henry Aaron.
You put Hank Aaron ahead of Willie Mays?
Willie Mays. It's really that baseball is the toughest one. I don't know that there's necessarily a wrong answer. I would go Gretzky, that's easy.
If you go outside of the four major sports, then it becomes even difficult. What do you do with Muhammad Ali? What do you do with Jesse Owens?
Yeah, you're right.
What do you do with Jackie Robinson?
You almost have to add a track and field.
Wait a minute. Did we overthink it with baseball? Jackie Robinson, maybe ahead of everybody?
I think probably Henry Aaron is the guy.
But is there a Henry Aaron if Jackie Robinson doesn't break the color barrier?
Well, here's the thing. Somebody was going to break the color barrier.
Yeah.
Somebody was going to do it. I mean, Larry Doby did it the next year in the American League. So somebody was going to break it. It was Jackie Robinson. He was the perfect guy. He had a phenomenal career. He also, obviously, an unbelievable track and field athlete. Henry Aaron, over a longer period of time, became a legendary figure by breaking a record once thought unbreakable.
Right.
And dealt with a lot of the same racism that sadly still existed.
Is universally respected as both a player and a person. You know, so I told you when April 15th was Jackie Robinson Day.
Yeah.
And I told you I was going to go back and watch 42.
Yep.
One of the things that jumped out at me about 42 that I didn't remember from the first time I watched it is Chris Maloney, the guy from Law & Order, plays Leo Durocher.
Yeah, sure.
Do you remember why Durocher got suspended for a year?
No.
Either did I. He was having an affair with a married woman.
Okay.
And he got caught like sneaking her out of the hotel by like a gossip columnist.
Yep.
And like the Catholic Church was a major baseball sponsor.
Yeah.
and they complained to Happy Chandler, the commissioner.
You're kidding me.
And Chandler suspended him for 1 year for violating the morals clause in his contract.
Wow.
At least that's the way it was portrayed in the movie.
Wow.
Now I'm sure there may be, like, as years have gone by, they may have said, I heard there may have been, like, the way they officially did it was that he was consorting with shadowy figures.
Oh, okay.
That's the way. But, so you could say that he was, you know, but in the movie, that's the way.
Consorting with shadowy figures sounds really, really damaging.
I just looked it up. The official reason for his suspension was that he had an accumulation of unpleasant incidents. And
these are so generic. The guy could have done anything. All he did was date a married woman, it sounds like.
They, you know, apparently he was friends with some gamblers, too. But in the movie, they portray it as strictly an issue with sleeping with. Okay, so DeRocher was suspended. Commissioner Happy Chandler cited DeRocher's string of moral shortcomings. Nightlife figures, scandalous marriage with charges of adultery, bigamy, contempt of court, gambling debts, association with known gamblers, and nightlife figures. But the way they portray it in the movie, it's he basically got in trouble for hooking up with a married woman.
Wow. Wow. And that was enough.
Yeah.
And what year was that?
47, Jackie Robinson's rookie year, remember?
Can you imagine? That was enough.
And then they brought in Bert Schotten, who was like this nice guy that that
was
came
not,
in and replaced
not sneaking
Durocher.
Around and consorting with shadowy figures. All right, coming up next, last night, one of the most interesting parts of Last Dance was the Republicans buy shoes to quote. I want to circle back to that. Plus, I remember, John, I remember the Atlantic City story so clearly because I had been in L.A. doing talk radio for just about a year. And I think it's impossible to – it was sort of the beginning of sports talk radio that really explored and delved into stuff. I want to talk about that coming up too. Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right, 710 ESPN last night, another episode of The Last Dance, another two episodes. Really interesting stuff. This was the final season of Michael Jordan's first three-peat. During that story, after game one against the Knicks in the Eastern Conference Finals, Michael Jordan made what is now considered to be an infamous trip to Atlantic City to gamble and to kind of clear his mind. Now, I remember, John, doing sports talk radio in L.A. when that broke, and that was a gigantic story. Does Michael Jordan care? Does Michael Jordan even give a damn about advancing in the playoffs? Is he done? Is it over? Has he lost his drive? All that kind of stuff. Do you remember how strong the reaction was to that?
Yeah, and looking back, it was, you know, who cares if he goes gambling in Atlantic City? He said he was back by 1 in the morning. Most of those guys I'm on the road with, they're out till, you know, they go to the movies or they'll go to dinner and they get back that late. I mean, looking back, it seems like our anger was misplaced.
Completely misplaced.
And they came back and won the series. The Bulls came back and won that series.
Yeah, and of course went to the finals. The other thing that I think is, but I thought that was sort of the beginning of the nitpicking at Michael Jordan. We talked to Sam Smith a while ago. You know, Sam wrote that book. There was the Atlantic City trip. There were the stories about him betting just a gajillion dollars on golf, which, I mean, I don't know. Do you bet on golf?
Very little. Like yesterday I lost, and I lost $10.
$10?
Yeah.
And he would lose, what'd he lose, like a million or something?
Yeah, so way more.
Some crazy amount playing golf, which is just astounding, but you know, he's probably got it in his pocket. He's worth, you know, $1 billion. He owns an NFL, an NBA franchise. He probably
has
on $1 billion.
There are a lot of guys who play golf for a lot of money. I one time was playing, and I didn't have a tee time, and I was out of town, and I woke up early, and I called a friend of mine or texted him and said, hey, if you got a spot, I'd love to play, and he had a regular game. And he goes, okay. He goes, I put you in the money game. And I went, okay, I just appreciate you getting me in. Thank you. And like six or seven holes in, I said, what do we stand to win or lose here? And he goes, most you can win or lose is like $800. And I went, what? $800? He goes, don't worry about it. You're playing good. I didn't play great after that. I ended up breaking even. But, man, you got to be careful. You got to ask because a lot of guys play for a lot of money.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about the famous Harvey Gantt story. So Harvey Gantt was an African-American Democrat who was running against Jesse Helms, who was a Republican and an absolute virulent racist in the state of North Carolina. And Michael Jordan famously chose not to endorse Harvey Gantt, instead saying Republicans buy shoes too. He said it was joking. It was on a bus, but it's been told ever since. At one point, I was told, nah, that never really got said. Last night, Jordan made it clear that it did get said, whether in a joking manner or not. Here's a little bit of President Obama, along with, I think, some Michael Jordan, talking about that incident from last night's Last Dance.
Any African-American in this society that sees significant success has an added burden. And a lot of times America is very quick to embrace a Michael Jordan or an Oprah Winfrey or a Barack Obama so long as it's understood that you don't get too controversial around broader issues of social justice.
Part of the reason he remained popular is that he never did anything to piss anybody off. Probably the most controversial thing Jordan said in his career was when Harvey Gantt was running for Senate to be the first African-American from North Carolina to serve in the U.S. Senate. Michael would not come out and endorse or support Gantt and was quoted as saying, Republicans buy sneakers too.
To a race.
I don't think that statement needs to be corrected because I said it in jest, you know, on a bus with, you know, with Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen, and it was, you know, thrown off the cuff. My mother asked to do a PSA for Harvey Gantt. And I said, look, Mom, I'm not speaking out of pocket about it. I don't know. But I will send a contribution to support it, which is what I did.
Conservative income.
So for me, I understand the premise. In other words, if you have a brand, like Michael Jordan had a real brand and continues to have a brand, you don't want to weigh into a political battle. At the same time, I think this would have been a very safe place for him to go all in. Jesse Helms was trying to resegregate schools, wanted to separate white and black kids all over again at the time that he was running for the Senate. He had a 16-day filibuster trying to stop the Martin Luther King holiday because he felt it wasn't appropriate. Like, this was a really, really bad guy. I think that this is one place where Jordan could have weighed in without damaging his brand.
Not sure. Even though all that stuff you said about Jesse Helms is true, he was elected four times in North Carolina. So either the people in North Carolina saw another side of him, or the people in North Carolina all agreed with him. And nothing Jordan says is necessarily going to change that.
Jordan could have been a difference maker in that. He could have.
But it's not guaranteed. I mean, I always worry.
More African-American voters coming out to vote.
Yeah, I always wonder how much a difference in like that makes. Like, tons and tons of celebrities supported John Kerry. Tons of celebrities supported Al Gore.
Donald Trump. Tons of celebrities.
Yeah,
tons
more for
tons of celebrity George Bush.
More for Hillary.
Tons and tons of celebrities for Hillary. Yeah.
Yeah. More and you know, Hillary.
But let's face it, certain endorsements mean more than other endorsements. Certain endorsements, I think, do. A Barack Obama endorsement, a Michelle Obama endorsement, a George Bush endorsement. I mean, on either side,
okay,
there are
certain
candidates that I think benefit from endorsement. From
okay,
well,
let's just use that those three that you just happened to go to.
Okay,
none of them supported Donald Trump, and he's now president.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean those endorsements weren't meaningful.
Means they weren't good enough to win. So
yeah,
I mean,
but it doesn't mean they're not. It still doesn't mean they're not meaningful endorsements.
Yeah, I have a difficult time criticizing Jordan for doing what we're told at ESPN we have to do. You know, we can't weigh in on this stuff. And Jordan just made a decision that he's not going to weigh in on it. He just said, I have a brand. I want to protect it. And like I was talking about earlier, most mega, mega sports celebrities in that era in particular.
In that era, without question.
And really almost since. Now is the first real group, but not, and now even like the guy who probably makes more money in endorsements than anybody is Tiger, and I have no idea where Tiger stands politically.
Well, Tiger's, I don't know that Tiger necessarily, given what happened in his life, necessarily his endorsement means as much.
But I'm just saying that he is one of the highest paid current athletes in the world.
Correct.
Whether it be from, winning golf tournaments or getting, just brands.
Well, I think it's the NBA guys that are ones that that are,
yeah, that's true.
There. Like even the NBA guys are the ones that are on the cutting edge of, hey, I'm gonna take a stand. I'm gonna take a position. You don't hear NFL guys do it particularly. You don't hear Major League Baseball guys do
it. Yeah, true.
But you do hear NBA guys do it, and they have significant brands. LeBron James, right under right in our own town, is probably the most socially active professional athlete we have right now.
Right, but you're right. The NBA is kind of has decided they are going to speak their minds. They might be the only sport. Can you think of a politically active anybody from any other sport?
Well, I mean, of course, the famous case is Colin Kaepernick.
Cost him his career. Right. I think that's Jordan's point, that he decided to,
He felt like it would cost him his career. Yeah, there's no question about
or
that.
Or at least cost him a lot of money and his brand a lot of money. He was probably too talented to afford to cost him his career. But that was interesting that I wondered if they were going to get into that at all. Like,
I never thought it was true. I had heard for years that it was true, and then for a long time there was a popular theory that he never actually said it. He may have felt it, but he never actually said it. And last night he said it very specifically. It doesn't need to be refuted. It is something that he said.
Right. There's a couple of other issues regarding Jordan that I'm pretty sure this documentary is not going to touch, but I don't know, because I would have said that was probably one too.
By the way, apocryphal, John, it makes perfect sense. Of doubtful authenticity, though widely circulated as being true.
Oh, yeah. That was a good use of that.
That's what I always thought. That's what I was told.
Do you think that, so we're six, boy, can you believe we're six parts down on this documentary? We now have fewer left than
fast.
We've seen.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you
I
think.
I almost wish they'd do one a Sunday.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you think they'll touch the murder of his father?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you heard Sam Smith a little bit earlier this hour talk about, he was more than just his father. He was his best friend. I don't know if you can tell the story about Michael Jordan without telling the story of his father. Do you?
I don't know if they'll go there. I do.
Really?
What Sam said was there was a large media throng saying that Jordan's gambling, and according to Sam, it was incredibly unfair.
Yes.
Incredibly unfair. But Sam brought it up on our show. He said there were media every single day, and this is one of the reasons Michael stopped talking to the media in some cases, that were trying to tie the death of his father to his gambling debt.
Yep.
That the two things were related. Do you think the doc even brings that up?
I don't think the documentary would bring that up. Again, Jordan is, is he an executive producer on this? He's
right.
Something on it. But I do, I mean, I
even
I
if it
tell,
even if it was untrue and unfair, you don't think he'll, so that's one thing that I'm curious to see in these remaining four
to
episodes.
See if he'll refute that.
Correct. And talk about the
that, by the way, feels like an urban legend to me.
Okay. But Sam brought it up. We didn't even ask him about it, and Sam brought it up
sure.
that, when we interviewed him. The other one is Michael went through a pretty high-profile divorce. do you think it ever comes up?
High-profile divorce.
And he has kids. He hasn't talked at all about his kids.
Sure, he hasn't talked about his kids.
Do you know how many kids Michael Jordan has?
I know he's got twins right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say he's got five.
Correct. Three with Juanita, his wife that he got divorced from.
Yep.
And the twin girls are with Yvette, the one he's married to now.
Right.
He hasn't really broached the subject of being a father or his kids.
True.
Or his, if the divorce, I think that those things are just kind of all off the table. So,
yeah, I mean, the stuff that gets really personal, it'll be fascinating to see because, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, it's kind of what Michael is comfortable with.
This is what Ken Burns was criticizing. He said that if you're going to do an honest documentary about Michael Jordan and his career, you've got to be willing to go to the places that he doesn't want to go. My argument would be you have no Last Dance documentary without Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, it's
so I'd rather have this, what we have, than nothing.
It is a documentary. It's just not journalism, right? It's not journalism in the truest sense of the word. It's like reading an autobiography versus a biography.
Well, it's
somebody outside writing.
Yeah, it's like somebody said to me, I mentioned at some point, maybe it was Friday when you weren't here, that over the weekend, the Laker Network, Spectrum Sportsnet, ran The Birth of a Dynasty, which was 4 hours of how Phil Jackson got the Lakers back up into a dynasty and really about the three-peat.
Yep.
And I had one tweet or text or something from somebody saying, well, the same problem with that is the same problem with the Bulls doc in that it's on the Laker network, so you won't hear the real truth. Do you need the real truth if it's a documentary about how you build a dynasty? If you're a Laker fan, wouldn't you be interested in that?
Oh, yeah, no question.
I watched the whole thing.
It's not like you learn nothing.
Correct.
It's going to be filtered through the eyes of someone, but that doesn't make it not interesting and not fascinating and not telling.
And not enjoyable.
Yeah,
I think The Last Dance is great. I think The Birth of a Dynasty is great. I mean, it seems like...
By the way, I don't think Ken Burns was necessarily criticizing. I think he was just pointing out it's something he wouldn't do because it's not journalism in the truest sense, which I understand. Technically, he's got a point. That doesn't mean it's not fantastic.
Yeah, matter of fact, to your point, he called Jason Hare, the director, over the weekend to clarify that. But he definitely criticized. He said, had they asked me to do it, I never would have done it because there would have been rules, you know, and his exact line was, that's not the way you do good journalism.
But
I don't know if this is journalism as much as it is. It's a story about Michael Jordan from his perspective.
Yeah. It's an autobiography. I mean, we were just talking about, will his divorce be in it? Will his dad be in it? I mean, it's his telling of his life and his career. So in the end, like you said, I wonder if they'll go there. The question is, will Michael go there? He's gone some places that are pretty fascinating and pretty interesting. And I'm surprised, by the way, that he said before the documentary actually aired, he said, I think people aren't going to like me after this.
Boy, not so far. I like him a lot.
I like him a lot. I mean, to this point, I'm pretty amazed by the guy. I don't find anything in there. I mean, he was a tough guy and, you know, he was serious about competition and, you know, he had to win at all costs and all that stuff. He would suck your soul and bingo. I mean, I get all that stuff, but I mean, I think it's a favorable portrayal of Michael as just one of the greatest competitors in the history of sports.
But, you know, one of the Chicago guys who came to the Lakers.
Yes.
And remember there were seven or eight of them. Told me, was talking to me about the difference between LeBron and Kobe.
Yep.
And they said, LeBron wants to beat you. Kobe wants you dead.
Yeah.
And if you look at what these guys are all saying about Jordan, Jordan wanted you dead.
Yep.
You know, he's just hopelessly competitive to a fault.
Yep. All right, coming up next for you is 5 o'clock Fast Track, Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN.